Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hello, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Before we get started today, I'd just like to let you know about our Streetwise Hebrew for the Times of Israel community, bite-sized audio Hebrew classes that you'll love. More about that at the end of today's podcast. Today is Thursday, October 14th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. Joining me today are founding editor David Horowitz and Startup Israel editor Ricky Ben-David. Hi to you both. David, you had a conversation with Nobuki Sugihara, son of Shiuni Sugihara, the World War II Japanese diplomat who saved thousands of Jews when serving as consul general in Kovno, Lithuania, again, during World War II. Nobuki, the son, was here for a ceremony in Jerusalem's Kiryat Hayovel neighborhood, which you wrote about, a story that just went up on our site. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think your pronunciation was pretty good, although I'm not an expert. And I've written a longer piece that was sent to the community actually yesterday and will appear on the site today. It's an incredible story. Chuni is the only Japanese national ever to have been honored as a righteous among the nations. And he was a diplomat. I mean, he was trying to work out on behalf of his government what the Nazis were up to, what the Soviets were up to. So he was a diplomat agent, shall we say, and he was in Kovno. And there was this period in 1940 when Jews, I mean, there were some Lithuanian Jews who turned to him, but broadly speaking, it was Polish Jews fleeing Poland, fleeing the Nazis into still independent Lithuania before the Soviets came in. And during those frenzied weeks, according to his son, he issued something in excess of 2,300 visas, transit visas for individuals and families. So more than 2,300 individuals were helped. That gave them permission to move out of Lithuania through the Soviet Union, cross all the way to Japan, and thence either to stay in Japan for some time or to move on to other destinations. Now, this is not the first time we've written about him and Amanda Borsheldan, who is usually presents these podcasts and who's away at the moment. She went to his ostensible hometown, because it's not even clear where he was born, where he's now sort of exalted as a hero. We've written about him in the past, but it's what was amazing to me was two things. First of all, that there weren't very many diplomats who did noble things. He was defying his government because you weren't supposed to be issuing visas for people who didn't have a guaranteed exit from Japan. That was the policy. And I imagine almost certainly the overwhelming proportion did not have visas to travel on after Japan. And yet he churned out these visas as fast as he could. He saved the entire Mir Yeshiva, the whole student body. And I met somebody at this ceremony who did have a U.S. exit visa, who came to Kovno, who got a visa from a Sugihara, who made it to America and then wrote to the yeshiva. His family were there. His descendants were there. It may be that letter reassured the members of the Mir Yeshiva that they should flee to Kovno, which they did, and all these visas were issued. So, the astonishing impact of one person doing something incredibly decent. And the second thing that was interesting to me was that he apparently really didn't realize quite how effective it had been. He wasn't the only person in this chain. There was lots of other goodwill and lots of other brave people who enabled all of this to work, because you can imagine the journey and the voyage and the innumerable places where this could all have gone wrong. But he died in 1986, and it was only then starting to come out that lots and lots of people had made it. And by everybody's unknowable estimates, maybe tens, maybe hundreds of thousands. His son says hundreds of thousands of people are alive today, whose families would not have come into being because the one ancestor or the family wouldn't have escaped. So one diplomat's defiance of Tokyo's policy, innumerable worlds that were saved.
David, who were some of the people at the ceremony?
Yeah, what was striking was the survivors and their descendants. So you had, you know, I wrote about them, and like I said, there's a second article coming out. The Feigenblum family, I think their name is. They had the list. You know, he's sometimes called the Japanese Schindler, and there was a copy of the typewritten list, several pages long, of the beneficiaries of these visas. There was somebody there, a Mrs. Pomerantz. She had framed all the documentation that ultimately paved the way to her existing. There's a deputy chief of mission. I think the wrong title is the kind of deputy ambassador, but the American deputy chief of mission here at the moment, his father was included on a visa, and he was there, as well as, so, you know, lots of survivors with, you know, everyone you spoke to had an extraordinary story and extraordinary gratitude. The one other thing that I should say, and the reason why I started looking at this is the son, who's the only son who's still alive now. He's 72. He wouldn't have been at the ceremony because Israel, I mean, this is, you know, ridiculous and ironic, but it ends well. Israel has regulations about non-nationals coming in. You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And there were lots of forms that were supposed to be filled in, and he filled in the forms. But on one of the forms, it asks you, if you get sick in Israel, where will you quarantine? And he not unreasonably replied, I don't know, ask my hosts. And he didn't get a visa. Israel did not give him a visa for the ceremony. Let me just say this again. Israel did not give him a entry visa, a travel visa, for a ceremony honoring his late father, who issued thousands of travel visas in breach of bureaucracy and saved all these lives. And it was only when my colleague, Laser Berman from the Times of Israel, we were contacted, and he wrote it up. And all of a sudden, you know, the wheels of government, which can be very efficient, you know, came into action, and the visa was issued. You know, as of 4 days before the event, this guy wasn't even coming because of, would you believe it, you know, the wrong forms, or the forms weren't filled in correctly.
It's not even really ironic. It's something else. Not sure what that is, but okay.
We'll go with obtuse if you like. We'll be polite.
Obtuse could be the right word, right adjective. Ricky, going over to you, you wrote this week about Israel's tech sector breaking capital funding records. This is an unbelievable series of figures. Firms raising a total of $17.78 billion in 575 deals since the start of 2021. It's a very far cry from the deals I used to write about in the late 1990s. Please explain what is going on here. What kind of change are we seeing here?
So we're seeing an increasing amount of money being poured into Israeli startups, and we can point to two trends. So at the moment, so far this year, in the past 9 months, we have $17.78 billion compared to last year, which was $10.3 billion. Last year, 2020 itself, that was a record year for funding. So we're almost, you know, double that. And by the end of the year, we might likely reach $20 billion. We'll have to see how that goes. And so we're seeing two things. We're seeing, if we're looking at the sectors that are drawing in this amount of money, cybersecurity, fintech, enterprise software, these sectors were already very strong in Israel, very specifically cybersecurity. But, you know, in 2020 and 2021, the year of the pandemic, there's been an accelerated need for these digital solutions, more people working from home and, you know, accessing these networks that could be vulnerable. So there's an increased demand for these technologies, and also fintech, to facilitate ways to do business in a period where so much business, especially small and medium-sized operations, were affected. It was very difficult to do. So people were looking for these solutions, and you see that. You see the money being poured into these technologies. One of the fastest-growing startups in Israel is has been Wiz, a cybersecurity company that specializes in securing cloud environments. It was founded just last year. It recently raised a lot of money, and it's being valued today at $6 billion.
That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. And, you know, in less than 2 years to go from a startup, and we still call it a startup because it's very new, but it's a $6 billion company at the moment. Another startup to look at is Melio, a fintech startup. It offers a payment platform for small and medium-sized businesses. And if we take a look at the founders of these companies, we're tapping into a different trend. So with Wiz, for example, the founders were, had a startup. They sold it to Microsoft in 2015, I think, for $300 million, which is very respectable. And then they went on to work at Microsoft to lead their cloud security group. And they went on to, you know, found this very successful startup that is now worth $6 billion. With Melio, the founders, the CEO specifically worked at PayPal. So we're seeing this new generation of founders who either previously founded startups, sold them, and then went on to work for these giant multinationals, you know, gathering a lot of experiences, making a lot of connections with investors and so on and so forth. So this is another trend we're seeing, and it explains the landscape at the moment, which is growing very, very quickly. So you have these second and third generation founders who also are founding companies, but also advising new startups, advising, you know, new entrepreneurs on the scene, sometimes backing them financially, you know, Israeli founders backing other Israeli founders. And you're just seeing a lot of activity in this space. And it's a big difference from 10, 15 years ago, isn't it? Where, you know, Israeli startups were you know, wanted to be sold, wanted to exit to the highest bidder and do it very, very quickly because they were good at, you know, building technologies. And now there's been a shift, and you hear these terms in the ecosystem from startup nation to scale up nation, which means that they want to grow, they want to build companies, they want to grow and expand and hire teams all over the world and eventually, you know, go public on different capital markets and not sell very, very quickly.
Wow, very fascinating. Just a question. Is there also a maturity kind of thing that's going on here? In other words, you talk about these founders who go on to other companies, they work there, they obviously make their connections there, and there's also the second and third generation entrepreneurs. But is there also a sense of this, okay, the Israeli market has been around now for a while, the high tech market, it's well known. It's been decades at this point. Is that also a part of the valuations and the funding that goes on here?
Israel has a very, very strong reputation across the world, which it built up over time and which has taken off in the last 10, 15 years. So the maturity angle taps into that. Like these founders are now, you know, they've made their money, they're coming back and they want to head companies that will, you know, are in it for the long haul. You know, they want to grow, they want to expand globally and really build these billion-dollar companies that will be around for decades, hopefully.
This Times of Israel podcast is brought to you by Koren Publishers Jerusalem. Whether you're looking to enrich your mind or your soul, Koren Publishers has it all. From Israeli history to the works of Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Steinsaltz, and other contemporary thinkers, including the brand new Magamon edition Koren Tanakh, with translation by Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, Jessica Sacks, and many others. Times of Israel listeners can get 10% off your entire order. Just go to korenpub.com and use the code TOIPOD, that's korenpub.com, and enter the code TOIPOD for your 10% discount.
Speaking of cybersecurity, David, ransomware attack at the Hillel Yafeh Hospital in Hadera. What can you tell us about that? It's a big one, maybe one of the biggest that we've seen here.
I don't remember anything like it. And, you know, as far as I know, they're not out of the woods yet. And again, listening to some radio reports in the last hour or two, they've got, never mind national experts, international experts. I don't think they're baffled. I think they have not found where they were vulnerable and how they were hacked. But they are very, very slowly only moving towards re-linking to the internet. So we're talking about a full day, which has seen a major hospital with a catchment area of many hundreds of thousands cancelling non-emergency surgeries, sending patients away in some circumstances. I think they've taken people who got there and needed treatment, but they've certainly been trying to minimize what they're doing. Doing admissions with pen and paper, carbon paper, is that what it's called? I think, you know,
yeah,
I think we've forgotten what
copies.
The words are.
Oh my God.
And you know, it's the individual machines that keep people alive and that are crucial to hospitals and that are not dependent on the internet have been functioning. But internet-related administrative and all kinds of other stuff, they've not been able to operate. Now, it's apparently the case that this is some ransomware attack, and this, the people who've done it are in it for the money. But they're talking about it in terms of, we don't think it's terrorism or it's not terrorism. But it raises the threat of outside nefarious terrorist forces being able to hack into, I mean, hospitals spectacularly vulnerable in terms of the sensitivity of their internet connections, and more generally. And that, you know, then that takes us to the whole other levels of the perennial Iranian-Israeli tensions. We know of relentless Iranian attacks to hack into Israel, to cyber attack Israel, to mess with our water. You know, there have been cases of that. And you can, you know, you can take this as far as you want. In an era where, as far as I understand, the big concern about cyber terrorism and what you can do online is that the offensive forces well, let's put it the other way around. The defensive forces are constantly playing catch up against the offensive forces, that technology is advancing all the time, that vulnerabilities do not have to be great to be devastating. And therefore, although in this case it seems to be ransomware, which, you know, the impact is the impact, and the potential, you know, danger is the potential danger, no matter who's behind it. But an attack like this is raising all sorts of other concerns. And the hospitals, you know, this hospital apparently met all the national requirements in terms of cybersecurity.
For protection.
It's not like, right. It's not like they, oh, really? My goodness, our computers could be attacked. We had no idea. It's not that at all. And yet, I mean, their grading apparently is excellent. And as the hospital director said on the radio this morning, obviously we need excellent plus plus, because the government standard, the bar is plainly not
too
high
low.
Enough. And they don't have a dedicated budget for this. This is something that hospitals have to do. So I think it's probably a landmark event, and it's going to force a real rethink and some major investment of resources and brain power.
Okay. And speaking of other large tech companies, Ricky, you wrote about Facebook this week, following up on last week's whistleblower testimony that really dealt a blow to Facebook. You spoke to local experts who said some very interesting things.
Yes, I spoke to Dr. Tehila Althusser-Schwartz at the Israel Democracy Institute, and she had some very interesting things to say. It's in an interview piece on the site. So she was basically saying that, you know, this is one of many, many scandals that Facebook has been involved in, and very likely not the last. Facebook has been selling the emotional crisis of teenagers and other vulnerable people to advertisers for years now, she's saying. So this is not new. And this new revelation, and it wasn't just the whistleblower testimony, it was also the outage. You know, it happened at the same time, which was very unfortunate for Facebook. It happened in the span of just,
right,
really just a few days. And the outage, the 6-hour outage on Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, just drew so much attention to the vulnerabilities that I guess people didn't really think, you know, could happen to Facebook. You know, it kind of shed more light on how it secures its systems and how its systems are so interconnected that way that it can take down three very major social media platforms, two of which enjoy a lot more positivity than Facebook, you know, Instagram and WhatsApp. Israel especially, you know, Israelis live on WhatsApp and other parts of the world, except in the US where it's less popular. But what the WhatsApp outage was a very big deal for so many people. And the argument is that finally this outage affected Facebook's pockets, right? Like it took a hit in the financial market, and it's actually had the backing of the financial markets, which is why all these leaks and all these scandals haven't affected it as much as this outage. And it's just part of the bigger picture of Facebook's activities on, you know, what it's doing security-wise, content-wise, how it's affecting our lives. And she argues that there's a shifting attitude towards Facebook that's been building up for several years now, but it's becoming more pronounced and urgent.
Yeah, I just want to say there was, you know, our communications minister reportedly is planning to take Facebook on quite aggressively. I don't know if we're going to see this, but he apparently is setting up a committee, and he's going to tell Facebook, either you take responsibility for your content. In other words, you accept liability for your content in a way that newspapers have to, but social media platforms have not. and start telling us the basis by which you advance certain posts and how your algorithm works, which I imagine Facebook will not really want to do, or we're going to move towards legislation. So I don't know if anything's going to come of this, but it will be interesting to watch.
I was also wondering, given the fact that WhatsApp was quiet that night and it was such a pleasure, how much Israelis who, like you said, Ricky, use WhatsApp incessantly, how much people really connected the two companies?
I think if they didn't, they certainly do now. You know, Facebook buying WhatsApp, I think it was in 2014 or 15 for something like $15 or $16 billion at the time, was huge news. And just the fact that all three of these networks went down just really brought to light how much of a problem it can be. And one of the questions regarding regulations is, you know, what is our first the regulators, what is the first move? Do they break that up? Do they force Facebook to sell off Instagram and WhatsApp, which existed, you know, before and were successful companies and growing, and Facebook bought them for its own reasons to kind of head off competition? So do we force them to sell it off because people are using these platforms very differently and they actually really like these platforms at the moment more than Facebook? Facebook has faced a lot of negativity for its branding in recent years. Where do we regulate? This was her, you know, big question. Like, what is the way forward? Do we regulate the content itself? Do we make it illegal for Facebook to do targeted advertising? Do we hold it, you know, responsible for the content, as the Israeli Minister of Communication suggested? The thing is, each country will have to make its own decisions about, you know, where it wants to take things. So, for example, if Israel wants to make it easier to sue Facebook and other social media platforms for the content and make it more transparent in terms of having to explain why it's taking down certain content or not taking down certain content. For anyone who's tried to report anything on Facebook and getting a very, you know, kind of unsatisfactory answer, that's a big thing. That's, if that happens, that will be a big change. Facebook itself argues that it has something like 40,000 people doing full-time moderation, which sounds like a lot, but it's a network of 3 billion people, and there's billions of pieces of content going up, you know, per minute. So is that enough?
Right.
Very, you know, it's clearly not enough. And it's not enough. And one of the big things the whistleblower shed light on was the focus on, you know, the English speaking world. And what about the rest of the world? There's just not enough monitoring of toxic, very harmful content out there.
Okay, Ricky, one more little piece to end this podcast. You wrote that drones delivered sushi, beer, and ice cream orders in Tel Aviv and to the media. Did you get anything? What was it like? Tell us.
I mean, everything looked intact. I took a peek at the sushi. It was fully assembled. It was all together properly.
Does it fall at your feet? Does it how does it actually come to your hands?
Yeah, the drones, you know, took off from the beach from Chof Hatzuk in Tel Aviv, took off to Herzliya to pick up some sushi, and then touched back down, you know, right off the beach in front of very bewildered beachgoers. Like, what is happening? And it really was just like one order of sushi, and there were dozens of members of the press. So I didn't have any. But it was a really cool experience. And, you know, if that is the future, assuming they, you know, there are a lot of hurdles, right? There's security issues and noise and, you know, large birds that they need to, you know, figure out, simultaneous flying. There's just a lot of things that they need to work out. This was the third demonstration of 8. In the coming, you know, in the coming months, there'll be a few more, and each demonstration tackles, you know, different aspects of this operation. So they're now at a point where, you know, they're testing these deliveries in central Israel, in Tel Aviv, and Yafo, Ramat HaSharon, Herzliya, and Chedera, which in which they started a few months ago. And they're just, you know, hoping to build this national drone network that will, the idea is to take these delivery cars and mopeds and you know, all these kind of vehicles off the road and into the sky. Whether that's a good idea, it looks like, you know, they think so, and they're building up to that.
Yikes. Okay. Definitely interested in hearing more about that. So we're going to close this podcast for today. Thank you to you both for being here. Just going to remind everyone that if you're interested in Streetwise Hebrew, you need to sign up for the Times of Israel community at our website, and you'll get to learn Hebrew phrases with Guy Charet. In the meantime, see you next week, and stay tuned for Times Will Tell, our weekly feature that comes out tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.